I'm Jamie from Manhattan, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You might know Mark Mothersbaugh as one of the founding members of the band Devo. But Devo is just one small part of a decades-long exploration of sonic and visual art, exploring what Mothersbaugh calls de-evolution, from which the name Devo derives. Mothersbaugh's art is the subject of an exhaustive new museum exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and its accompanying book, both of which are called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. Mark joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, myopia, you actually had, and I presume still have, myopia, right?
Yes, and it figured prominently into me becoming an artist, actually. So,
how would that kind of restrictive vision lead you to the visual arts?
I was one of five kids. It's not uncommon for myopia to go undetected for years when you're young, and I was in that category, so that I made it through second grade, almost all the way through second grade, without being able to see what a blackboard was, or be able to see. I knew where the door was because you could follow people and you would find it, and somehow I managed to make it to school every day. But it wasn't until the end of that school year that I got fitted with glasses, and within 5 minutes, I walked out of this optometrist shop, and I, for the first time, saw clouds and birds flying and telephone wires and rooftops and smoke coming out of chimneys and the tops of trees. And it was...
You had never seen any of that
before.
Well,
pictures and books, and I just assumed everybody else had the same vision that I had. I knew kids knew something I didn't know at school. You know, I knew that they knew answers to things like when the teacher would say, would you read the numbers on the board? And then I would go, what's a board? And then all the kids laughed, and then they go, all right, smart guy, get in the corner. And I'd be like, how do they know the right thing to say? But it made me start drawing. Like the next day, the teacher that had been inflicting corporal punishment on me said, hey, you draw trees better than me, and that kind of did it.
Wow. And so it was visual art first for you.
Yeah, I thought music was invented to torture me, because at the same time I got my glasses, I started taking keyboard lessons. And so my friends would be outside the window, like, making a face, you know, laughing while I'm sitting in there playing Bone Sweet Bone. And... you know, it wasn't until I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, because my dad would set a TV right next to the dinner table, because with five kids, that was one way to kind of control the chaos.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that and going, that's why I've spent my whole life being tortured with music lessons. And so...
Well, now, you mentioned there are five kids, three of whom would be in the original lineup of Devo.
And that would be correct, yes.
Yeah. Now... The band's sort of creation story is an odd one, because you were at Kent State at the time of the shooting.
Right.
And what did they closed the campus down after that tragic event, and for a couple of months you didn't have access to the visual, to the printmaking machinery that you'd been using.
Right. I met Jerry Casale in 69, and we collaborated on visual art projects, and we were both in bands that were kind of helping us pay our tuition and the way through school. And then we were also protesting and thought it was a good thing. And we were there for 30-some kids to get shot. And they did close the school down in May of 1970. And so Jerry would come over to my place, and we'd write music together, and we were trying to figure out what we were seeing in the world, and we decided we weren't seeing evolution, we were seeing de-evolution.
Well, now, so here's the question, is like, you know, with the band growing initially out of this kind of watershed moment in American politics, how did you and Jerry decide how overtly political your art was going to be, whether it was visual or musical?
Well, what really shocked us was when, you know, May they closed the school down. September they started it back up again. And when we went back to school, it was a totally different atmosphere. It had been this very exciting, full of, you felt empowered as a student before that. And then all of a sudden it was like, everybody was like, that was a little bit too real. Let's just get back to the business of school and forget anything about what's going on in the world around us. And music took a big turn, it seemed like, right at that time. It's like what came up next was disco and corporate, you know, like power rock. And both of them had politics that we weren't particularly enamored with. And it seemed like all the Bob Dylans of the world were gone. And so we thought, well, we're going to be musical reporters and talk about the good news of de-evolution.
Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo with me here in the Soundcheck studio. The exhibit of his visual art and some sonic art as well, which we can talk about, is called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. It opens on October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. The accompanying book is out on November 4th. And you can see some of the artwork that we'll be talking about on our website at soundcheck.org. I want to play a little bit of Mongoloid. This is the version that's on the first Devo record. There was the single before right. that as well, which has an even more raw sound. But it's, you know, is this kind of reportage of de-evolution?
Yeah, I think so. I think we decided we were going to get out our pad and paper and observe things and make our own comments, and Mongoloid fit very well into that.
This is from the first album called Are We Not Men? We Are Devo. And the song Mongoloid, which doesn't just appear on the first Devo record. Mark, it is also one of your earliest music videos, way in advance of MTV.
Yeah, ironically, that was the only video we never made ourselves. It was made by a video artist that resided in San Francisco at the time named Bruce Connor. And he had come to see the band at Mabuhay Gardens and really enjoyed the band, and he had seen films we'd made and then said, hey, can I make a film? Mm-hmm. And so I gave him a copy of the tape on quarter-inch reel-to-reel, and then came the video. He'd made an awesome video, too.
Yeah. Well, so did you guys for a lot of those early songs. And again, this sort of goes back to kind of the synchronicity between the visual and the sonic arts for you. I mean, you've sort of pursued both simultaneously.
Right. We were part of the of which is now very passé, but we were part of an emerging group of artists that felt like the idea was more important than the medium, and we felt we should be able to have access to whatever medium we wanted to that best solve the problem made the statement we were trying to make.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, here in New York in the late 70s, you had, you know, people like Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker, in a band, and
right.
you had people like Laurie Anderson, you know, playing the violin on Blocks of Ice, you know, the whole performance as an art unto itself.
Right. It was a good time. It was an interesting time in the arts. And before MTV, there was all this hope we thought, oh, what we're doing, being sound and vision artists, it's going to make rock and roll irrelevant. that's what we thought we were doing. We thought that all the art school students from around the world were going to take over pop culture. And they were allowed to become part of it, but they didn't really take over.
So you saw the mainstream culture devolving, and you saw the art students as the counterweight, the counterbalance to that.
Right. I saw. You know, Jerry and I, we were thinking of Devo. Like, there was Art Nouveau, there was Art Deco. Now there's Art Nouveau. We were turned on by all the art movements in Europe between World War I and World War II, you know, Bauhaus and Dada, and, you know, we were, you know, checking out things like Ballet Mécanique and the futurists in Italy who said an orchestra isn't enough to truly play the music of our culture now. We need other instruments like foghorns and airplane engines, and we thought that's exactly right.
Yeah. So there you guys were with your guitars held together with duct tape and all kinds of, like, weird sort of proto-electronic drums and things.
Yeah, my youngest brother, Jim, he played drums with us, and then I kept asking him for V2 rocket sounds and mortar blasts, and there was no electronic drum kits at the time, so he kind of cobbled together his own using an acoustic set going through acoustic guitar pickups into amps on stage, so he'd have wah-wah pedals and fuzz tones and echoplexes that it just made a kind of a incredibly noisy sound.
Yeah.
But I still miss it because it was the most artistic that Devo ever sounded.
Well, now, Devo started making a name for itself at the same time that the New York and London punk scenes were in full bloom. So, you know, almost inevitably you guys got lumped in with that. Did you feel any kinship with the punk scene here in New York?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I think seeing the Ramones kind of inspired us too. You know, it's like we were doing more bluesy. It was a little more bluesy, Captain Beefheart, sort of Flintstones meets the Jetsons, and then we came out to New York and saw what was happening and got really excited, and our songs became more succinct and. The tempo got upped and they became more aggressive. And
I do remember when the single of Sloppy came out before the first record, and I thought, wow, that's that's punk in several ways. Then the album version came out, and it was Brian Eno who produced the first Devo record. There's a timeline in the book that mentions a date in Toronto where David Bowie is introducing Devo and saying, I'm going to produce them. Whatever happened to that?
Everything happened in the summer of 77, basically, where we started playing New York. And actually, he came to see us at Max's Kansas City. And We play, you know, you played two sets. Mm-hmm. I forget. I think it might have been Suicide. I don't remember who the other band was that was on that night with us. And we played our first set, and then they played a set. And he came backstage and said, I want to take you guys to Tokyo this winter, and we'll do an album together. And we're like, that's great, because we're sleeping in an Econoline van tonight out in Broadway. And so he came out on stage on the second set and introduced us as the band of the future. And he made one caveat afterwards. He said, but if I get a part in this movie called Gigolo, we'll have to push it back to summer or something like that. And we're like, well, we don't have apartments anymore. We don't have anywhere to go. And so he called us up during the middle of the week and said, I just got the movie, so let's push it till Sunday, summer. And then the next week, Robert Fripp and Brian Eno came to see Devo at the same place. And we went over to Robert Fripp's house afterwards, and they said, hey, can we do anything to help you guys? And Eno said, hey, I'd love to produce you, and I'll tell you what, I know you don't have any money. We don't have a record deal, but I know we could get one, so I'll take care of all the arrangements to make sure you get to Germany, where there's a studio. I think he had just recorded music for Airports at this place called Connie Plank Studio.
Connie Plank, yeah.
Yeah, in Neunkirchen. So he took us over there. And Bowie would show up on the weekends because he was filming his movie in Berlin, and then he would come in on the weekends. And we would listen to them bicker about the credits for the Low album.
Which is also in progress at this period
of time.
As well. We're speaking with Mark Mothersbaugh, founding member and longtime lead singer of Devo and visual artist as well. And the occasion is the opening of the exhibit, Mark Mothersbaugh Myopia, which starts October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and the publication of the companion book of the same name, which is out on November 4th. And, you know, as you head through the period where Devo is taking over your life, you know, and you got the record deal and there's the touring and stuff, how did you keep the visual part alive? How did you keep the visual art going?
Well, Jerry and Bob and I were always in charge of our...
When you say Bob, is Bob
one Bob.
Or Bob two?
Bob
okay.
one. we were responsible for the visual arts in the band. And even when we made our record deal, we were afraid of the record company designing. We had these nightmares that they're going to design our record covers or our posters for us. And so we cut them off at the pass by going, we'll take 10% less royalties if you let us do our own album covers and our own graphics for our marketing. And they're like, they were kind of like, they were feeling like, wait a minute, did you just pay us to paint our fence for us? We're okay with that. And so we were still responsible for all of the graphics and all of the things like the red hats and the hairdos and things. We designed them ourselves.
And with what about the videos? I mean, the video for Girl You Want is, you know, it's almost like a send up of the tropes of the rock concert.
Well, Jerry and I we wrote all those concepts together, and we started doing films before there was a such thing as an MTV. So we were like the little rascals. Jerry directed these things. Chuck Statler produced them. He went to school with us at Kent, and I did storyboards with him, and we made up the stories ourselves. And oftentimes, we had an idea for a film before we had the song, and we would write a song to go with something that we were laughing about as an idea or something that interested us that we wanted to do.
Could you have an example?
Like Beautiful World was probably fit into that. We had talked about the kind of graphics and things that we wanted to do, and we're looking for a place for them to exist. And I had this music, and Jerry wrote lyrics to go over top of it.
So getting back to Girl You Want, which is from the album Freedom of Choice, was the intention here to kind of send up the usual interplay between band and adoring teeny bopper audience?
Yeah, we were making fun of the whole thing, and you know, we were doing things that made us laugh. We had my dad, General Boy, was in the background, like controlling Devo, like we were mechanical, you know, robots on stage, and we found a collection of real little girls and real little boys that would wear wigs and just dressed them all up as girls and had them in like a peanut gallery style audience. And then at the end, when they accidentally flipped the video colors so that everybody was purple instead of whatever our normal colors were, and everything was flipped backwards, we put it out that way and kept having panicked notes come back from different television networks where they're like, we don't know what's wrong with your film. We got the wrong film. Everything's crazy. And we said, well, it was meant to be that way.
So going back to your work with Brian Eno, who had these little oblique strategy cards that he would use, and one of them was honor thy error as a hidden intention.
Yeah, Brian was like, he was probably the best producer we could have been associated with, because he really put up with us, and we were you know, to get out of Akron, and you know, there was no Summer of Love ever in Ohio back in those days. So and bands didn't play original music. That was a big minus if you played anything that wasn't a top 40 hit.
Mm.
So we really thought we knew what the album was supposed to sound like before we even got there. So at a certain point, he just kind of went, okay, I'm going to do these extra tracks. You'll have them available. You can use them or not. And he was good to work with.
Yeah. Well, you know, honoring an error as a hidden intention, the video for this song, Girl You Want, are the videos part of the museum exhibit? Are they...
They're somewhat folded in.
Let's play a little bit of Girl You Want from the Devo album Freedom of Choice.
She sings on some while you can't see. She sits in the top of the greenest tree. She sends out an aroma of undefined love. It drips on down in a mist from above. She's just the girl. She's just the girl. The girl you want. She's just the girl. She's just the girl. The girl you want.
Girl You Want from Devo, the 1980 album Freedom of Choice, the video that went along with it showing an audience of adoring teeny boppers, and yet they're dancing to a song all about romantic failure. Mark Mothersbaugh and Jerry Casale, the sort of guys behind the video as well as the music in the band Devo, and Mark is here with me on Soundcheck today. The exhibit of his visual art opens October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and the book comes out on November 4th. Meanwhile, you can see a lot of Mark's art on our website at soundcheck.org. And when I say a lot, I mean there are 30,000 just of the postcard art that you've done pretty much throughout your career, right?
Yeah, it kind of started off in... like 69, 70, I found out that if you, there was something called mail art. And
right.
It was back when people relied on the post office for transmitting information. Now you just get garbage mostly. And
bills.
And bills, yeah. So, but there were, you could, if you sent a piece of art on a postcard to somebody like Robert Indiana or Irene Dogmatic or Image Bank or Ant Farm, they would send you something back. And if you were a kid living in Akron, Ohio, who was just in this cultural wasteland that, you know, had no connection to these places that you'd heard about, you mm-hmm. know, like Carnaby Street or Greenwich Village or you know, Sunset Strip, you know, you knew these places existed somewhere. They just weren't in Akron. And you could send these, nobody could send out a piece of art to these people, and sometimes they would send them something back, and it was pretty exciting. And I started, and because of my myopia, it was an easy size for me to work on, because, even my, right now, my glasses, they're to get 20/20 vision, it's like I'm looking into a doorknob.
Because they're so thick.
Yeah, because so like I'm bending the walls when I go like this, and you just learn to ignore it. So
wow.
Let you be warned if you ever get in a car with me.
I'm driving.
Yeah. So these size cards was good, and then I realized it was kind of more of a they were autobiographical, and they were kind of like a diary. So I started saving them. And, you know, when Devo was traveling, it's like that was a way I could still keep doing visual things and I could write lyrics and things like that and collect them on these pieces of paper. And, so zoom ahead 40-some years and now there's like, you know, 350, I don't even know how many books that each have 100 of these things. That's one of the few things I actually was capable of archiving successfully in my life.
Well, there's a lot more in the museum exhibit as well. All right, now, I did notice in the credits for Pee-wee's Playhouse when that started, music by Mark Mothersbaugh.
Come on in and pull yourself up a chair. begin, it's time to wet down your hair.
And then after that, when my kids started listening to Rugrats, you know, same thing. You did come to Hollywood through a kind of a circuitous route.
Yeah, I mean, after Devo, you know, just after we saw people get shot at our school, we thought, well, how do you change things? It's not through rebellion in this country. They just put you down like that when they finally had enough. And so we looked around to see who was changing things, and it looked to us like it was Madison Avenue. We were listening to these diabolical commercials on TV and the radio where there'd be like somebody in a Burger King commercial to the tune of Pachelbel's Canon going, hold the pickles, hold the lettuce special. And it was like this beautiful piece of music that had been subverted into a ditty to sell crap to Americans. And I was impressed. And I thought, well, the techniques are how you do it. You do it. You go into the belly of the beast. And so that led us to Hollywood. And, you know, I found out that working on TV and film and in commercials and in video, you could do a lot. Mm-hmm. And you could put a lot of things right out in front of people, and they wouldn't necessarily notice it. But in the same way that Whippet lured people into Devo, and then they later would go, what does this song Jocko Homo mean? Or you know, what is freedom? What do they mean? Freedom of choice is what you want. Freedom of choice is what you got. Freedom from choice is what you want. And so, you know, it's like we like the idea of you know, giving Devo the acid test and like just going right into middle, as close as we could to middle America, which was kind of hard for us because we were pretty far out on the fringe of things to begin with.
Yeah. And yet it worked out really well. I mean, you know, the scores to the kid shows worked out really well. And then you hooked up with Wes Anderson. I, you know, about a year or so ago, I sat a bunch of my friends down and said, you have to watch Moonrise Kingdom. It has the best use of sound and music I have ever seen in a film. The way he uses the Benjamin Britten, the way Alexandre Desplat does the scoring. And then what did you do in that film?
I was more the conceptual artist for it, and did field drums for the kids and for the you know, the campsites, mm-hmm. and mixed it with tom-toms so that it would be kind of like somewhere between this kind of fantastic Indians meet you know, cowboys kind of sound design. But the movie, although my part was relegated to being just this one small area, the movie actually gave me an opportunity to do something. It inspired me to do something else, and that was, I was looking at footage of the kids running through the woods with no sound on it that Wes had sent me, and I thought, wow, it's kind of weird without any natural, you know, wind blowing or birds or anything. And I went over to this, I have a lot of collections, I'm a collector, and I started going through this collection of bird calls, and I was playing these bird calls and started writing music for bird calls, and I thought, well, I'd love to write a bird call orchestra. And I kind of forgot about the movie and just got into that for a while. And it led to meeting a guy who builds carousel calliopes, and we built this machine that plays like about 50 or 60 bird calls at once, and you can control it with a keyboard so that they would be playing in real time. So it wasn't just like you were playing samples, which would quickly just sound like samples, but you would have this device that you could adjust constantly, and so now I have this new instrument.
The orchestrion.
Yes.
Which, did you know that Pat Metheny was also at around the same time inventing his orchestrion?
Well, he worked with the same engineer that was like building those things. Yeah. And actually I learned from some of his mistakes because he had this brave idea that he was going to control it in real time live, and There's just inherent delays, and it's an impractical. It was an impractical idea, although it was a brave and wonderful concept of what he did. It was hard to make it pay off the way he was trying to, and so I went for mine is a combination of things that are pre-recorded, and I can control the machine with a computer.
And they're also, again, visually, they're sculptures of a sort. I mean, they're part of this exhibit as well, and they're really interesting to look at.
It's a really interesting machine because there's, you know, like little leather sacks that are getting tapped by some sort of a device that is making a peeping sound, or there's or rubber tubes with little whistles on them are being shook by the machine, or it's just blowing air through cuckoos and hummingbird calls and things like that, and there's slides that have to be manipulated. So there was a lot of mechanics involved in it. So it's kind of an interesting machine to watch it play.
So the orchestrions, you can see some of them on our website at soundcheck.org, and they will be part of the exhibit that opens October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. And over the next couple of years, we'll travel around and eventually wend its way to New York. There is the accompanying book. Both are called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. The book is out on November 4th, and Mark's been here with us in the Soundcheck studio today. Mark, it's an almost overwhelming amount of stuff, but congratulations on the exhibit and the book, and thanks for joining us.
It's an honor to be here with you.
We want to know what you think about Soundcheck. Tell us what you think of this segment or about the podcast in general. Email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's soundcheck@wnyc.org or 866-939-1612.